In the grim darkness of the far future, even death is no excuse to stop fighting. For the most elite warriors of humanity, the Adeptus, Astartes, the Space Marines, duty can extend beyond the grave. Today, we explore the Dreadnought, arguably the most terrifying Space Marine of all, a fallen hero encased in a walking sarcophagus of adamantium and ceramite, still meting out the Emperor's vengeance. This is a tale of warriors too stubborn to die, of legends who trade mortal flesh for cold steel, and of the eternal bond between a Space Marine's courage and the machine that sustains him. Welcome to a story of war unending. A Dreadnought is not merely a tank or a suit of armor, though it may resemble both. It is a towering cybernetic combat walker, a fusion of man and machine. Picture a 10-meter-tall giant striding through smoke and rubble, its footfalls shaking the ground. Its arms might mount roaring heavy bolters or crackling energy claws that can rip a battle tank in half. Shells that would obliterate an ordinary soldier ping off its hull. It fights with the skill and ferocity of an Astartes veteran, yet has the durability and firepower of an armored vehicle. To anyone facing it, the Dreadnought is war made incarnate, implacable, remorseless, and all but unstoppable. Yet, inside that metal behemoth is something even more fearsome. The remains of a Space Marine hero whose body was broken, but whose will refused to surrender. A Dreadnought is essentially a life support sarcophagus built into a combat walker. Within its armored torso lies a living, if mutilated, Space Marine, often a limbless, scarred torso, sustained by humming generators and nutrient fluids. This fallen warrior is permanently interfaced with the machine through neural links, a mind impulse unit, able to move the Dreadnought's limbs as if they were his own. The massive mechanical arms become his arms, the purring reactor heart becomes his heart. In essence, the Dreadnought's metal body is an extension of the Space Marine's will, driven by a mind that has witnessed a lifetime of battle, and then some. Historically, the concept of the Dreadnought stretches back to the Emperor's earliest conquests. Proto-Walker suits existed during the Unification Wars on Terra, though those were primitive contraptions by later standards. It was during the Great Crusade that the true Dreadnought came into prominence. The Legiones Astartes of that era fielded advanced patterns such as the Contemptor and Derridaeo, sleek, powerful ancestors of the modern Dreadnought, to great effect. Entire formations of Dreadnoughts, known as Talons, would thunder across alien battlefields, spearheading assaults and crushing opposition that even ranks of Space Marines struggled to overcome. Many of the Dreadnoughts still in service today are literally the same chassis from those ancient wars, painstakingly maintained and revered. After the Horus Heresy, the galaxy-wide civil war that shattered the Imperium 10,000 years ago, much knowledge was lost or restricted, and the sacred art of constructing new Dreadnoughts dwindled. The Adeptus Mechanicus guarded the remaining standard template constructs for Dreadnoughts zealously. As a result, every chapter in the post-heresy age often has only a handful of these venerable war machines. Each Dreadnought is effectively irreplaceable. When one is lost, it's not merely a military loss, but a cultural and spiritual one for the chapter. Over the millennia, there have been attempts to innovate or rediscover Dreadnought designs, some successful, like the recent Primaris patterns, and some forgotten. But by and large, the Dreadnoughts that stride to war in the 41st millennium carry the legacy and even the physical relics of those built in far earlier times. They are relics as much as warriors, links to an era when gods and primarchs walked the stars. How does one end up entombed in such a walking tomb? It's not a fate any Space Marine actively seeks out. There is no career path for becoming a Dreadnought. The only way to earn this dubious honor is to get yourself nearly killed in a manner so glorious that your chapter refuses to let you actually die. We're talking about the valiant last stand, the single-handed defense of a breached fortress gate, the slaying of a Xenos warlord at the cost of one's own life. Feats that pass into legend. When a space marine suffers mortal wounds, say, blown apart by a plasma blast, bisected by the claws of a tyrannid monstrosity, or crushed under a collapsing building, and yet somehow clings to the last threads of life, his apothecary, battlefield medic, may retrieve what's left of him. If that warrior is deemed exceptionally valorous and too valuable to lose, and if a dreadnought chassis is available, the chapter will enter him within the sarcophagus of a dreadnought. In other words, instead of a funeral, he gets an upgrade. This upgrade, however, is as much a curse as it is an honor. Imagine a waking existence confined to a metal coffin, wired into machines, kept alive by tubes and cybernetics. For the dying space marine, it's a second chance to serve, but at the cost of ever again living as a man. Once interred, he will never again know the sensation of sunlight on his face or wind in his hair, if he had any hair. Many space marines are bald, but that's the least of his worries now. He will never take off that armor. It is his body now. The transformation is irreversible and total. From the moment the dreadnought's hatch is sealed, the space marine inside ceases to be a flesh-and-blood warrior and becomes something between a man, a machine, and a legend. Space marines refer to their dreadnoughts as ancients or old ones. These warriors have truly earned those titles. Some have been fighting, on and off, for centuries or millennia. Their memories stretch back to times that other marines know only from history books or myth. They remember the chapter's founding heroes, bygone crusades, even the heresy itself if they're old enough. This makes them living repositories of knowledge and tradition. A dreadnought might recall battle tactics from a war fought 5,000 years ago as if it were yesterday, because for him, it practically was. Such ancient wisdom makes them invaluable as advisors and mentors to their chapter. But it also means they carry heavy burdens of grief and experience. They have watched countless battle brothers, and perhaps friends, if space marines dare use the word, grow old, die, or turn to dust while they endure. They've seen the galaxy change around them, and not always for the better. To preserve both their lives and sanity, dreadnoughts spend most of their time in slumber. Extended neural interfacing with a war machine takes a mental toll. Over long periods, an awake dreadnought's human mind can grow weary, confused, even unstable. Thus, when not fighting, the custom is to let these warriors rest. Within each chapter's fortress monastery, there is usually a reverent hall or vault where the dreadnoughts are housed. Picture a grand chamber lined with alcoves or raised daises, each holding a silent giant shrouded in semi-darkness. These resting dreadnoughts might be posed kneeling, like knights awaiting a call to arms, or secured in stasis caskets. Tech marines and chapter serfs tend to them as if caring for slumbering kings. Oil is applied to joints, purity seals and parchments bearing prayers are affixed to armor plates, and soft litanies of maintenance are chanted. It's both an engineering task and a religious ritual. Battle brothers occasionally visit the hall to pay respects, as one would visit a mentor's tomb, except these tombs might stir and speak if duty demands. One cannot help but wonder, what does a dreadnought sense or dream during those long years of sleep? Some say that entombed space marines experience a sort of suspended animation, a dreamless void that makes centuries pass in an eye blink. Others suggest their minds wander in nightmares or memories, reliving old battles, conversing with the shades of long-dead comrades, perhaps even communing in some distant way with the Emperor's spirit. There are tales of dreadnoughts awakening and describing vivid dreams of feasting in the halls of their Primarch or fighting phantoms of the past. Whether those are true visions or just the echo of a superhuman mind trying to fill the darkness, only the ancients themselves know, and most aren't inclined to indulge idle questions about their sleep. What is certain is that awakening can be jarring. Imagine opening your eyes and the last time you were conscious was 200 years ago. The world has moved on without you. Occasionally, an ancient will awaken disoriented, believing himself still in a previous era, or demanding to speak with a commander who died long ago. The chapter's caretakers handle these moments with gentle respect, and perhaps a quick briefing on what millennium it is now, before aiming their ancient warrior toward the new enemy at hand. When the chapter has need of one of its dreadnoughts, the awakening is a moment of both reverence and urgency. A tech marine will oversee the reactivation sequence. In the quiet gloom of the dreadnought vault, runes begin to glow, machines hum, and the sarcophagus's occupants are brought back to awareness. Hydraulic locks disengage with a hiss. The dreadnought's optics flare like giant eyes opening. Often the first sound is a booming vox-amplified growl as the ancient greets the waking world, sometimes a recitation of his name and honors, or perhaps a curt demand for a status report. "Who do I need to kill this time?" being a perfectly valid opening line for some of them. Ritualistically, an honor guard of space marines might be present, standing at attention. They treat the dreadnought not merely as a war machine, but as the honored veteran and comrade that it is. It's customary to salute and formally address the awakened one. "Ancient, the chapter calls upon you." Or, "Brother, we march to war and would be honored by your presence." Only then does the great warrior truly stride forth, the slumber of ages sloughing off and the familiar lust for battle rising to the fore. On the battlefield, a dreadnought is a fulcrum of power, serving as mobile heavy support, a salt breaker, and inspirational icon all at once. It can dramatically shape the course of an engagement. Let's paint a picture. A fortified city under siege, hostile forces entrenched in buildings and behind gun emplacements. Space Marine assault squads advance cautiously, firefights echoing down ruined streets. Then, with a bone-shaking crash, a dreadnought drops from a Thunderhawk gunship or emerges from a breached gate. Gunfire that rattled the Marine's power armor now pitter-patters ineffectively against the dreadnought's adamantium hide. The enemy panics as this 8 to 10 meter giant wades forward. A heavy bolter on its arm unleashes a storm of explosive rounds that tear through barricades. A built-in flamethrower gouts cleansing fire into a sniper nest on an upper floor, flushing out screaming foes. Reaching a reinforced door blocking the way, the dreadnought doesn't bother with breaching charges. It simply slams its power fist into the barrier, tearing it off its hinges in one wrenching pull. The ground trembles under its stride as it leads the Space Marines deeper, a literal engine of war at the forefront. For the enemies of the Imperium, facing a dreadnought is a nightmare made real. Even the bravest or most fanatic often quail at the sight. A common soldier might empty his entire magazine at it and accomplish nothing except drawing the ancient's gaze, which tends to be the last thing that soldier sees before a burst of cannon fire or a massive metal foot comes down. There are countless anecdotal reports from guardsmen and adversaries alike. The moment when a dreadnought appeared on the battlefield was the moment the fight turned hopeless. It's not just the physical threat. It's the psychological weight. How do you kill something that is already dead? How do you stop a warrior who is literally entombed in armor and has nothing left to lose? Seeing one of your shots blow a chunk off a dreadnought's plating, only for it to keep advancing relentlessly, can break the will of even hardened fighters. It's the sort of terror that sends lesser men fleeing, though if they're lucky, the Dreadnought might not bother chasing stragglers, preferring to crush more significant targets and leave the mop-up to younger Marines. For the Space Marines fighting alongside a Dreadnought, the effect is the opposite. It is deeply inspiring, and occasionally a little intimidating, in an awe-struck way. Imagine being a young battle brother who has only heard tales of the chapter's ancient heroes, and now one of them is literally fighting next to you. You might hear the ancient's voice growling tactical advice over the voxnet. Squad Beta, move to flank. I will cover. That voice sounds like what it is. A man speaking from inside a vault, amplified through grating speakers, often with a tinge of dry wit or seasoned confidence that no 30-year-old sergeant could match. Fighting beside a Dreadnought, Space Marines feel the weight of their chapter's history driving them on. It's as if the chapter's founder or a legendary hero has returned to lead them. In practical terms, Marines often form up around the Dreadnought, using it as moving cover, coordinating their attacks with its thunderous strikes. The Dreadnought might be directing less experienced brothers, pointing out enemy armor to kill or breaches to exploit. In the chaos of battle, hearing that crackling, authoritative voice say, "Well struck, brother," after you take down an enemy can be the highest praise a young Space Marine ever dreams of. Dreadnoughts themselves come in various patterns and configurations, tailored to different combat roles. The most venerable standard pattern in the 41st millennium is the Castra Ferrum pattern, often just called the MIKV or MAC-4 Dreadnought in some tomes. It's the classic boxy-looking Dreadnought that most Imperial citizens might picture if they've heard of these legends. Typically, one of its arms ends in a gigantic powered fist, sometimes with built-in storm bolters or a flamer, and the other arm is a mount for a heavy weapon, such as an assault cannon that spews explosive rounds, a multi-melter that can turn a bunker to molten slag, or twin-linked las cannons capable of punching through tank armor at range. On its hull, it might also carry auxiliary weapons, smoke launchers, grenade launchers, or a stubber turret. Some Castra Ferrum variants are tweaked for specific roles. The ironclad Dreadnought is an uprated siege model. It carries extra frontal armor plating like a tortoise shell, making it even tougher at close range. Ironclads often wield seismic hammers or chain fists. Imagine a massive jackhammer or chainsaw built into its arm to pulverize fortifications, and shoulder-mounted hurricane bolters or melt-a-gun arrays for extra punch. These are the ones you send in to crack a fortress gate or root out foes in claustrophobic ship-to-ship boarding actions. Another variant is the Hellfire or Fire Support Dreadnought configuration, beloved by chapters like the Ultramarines. A Hellfire pattern foregoes close combat weapons entirely, and instead sports long-range guns on both arms. For example, a pair of twin-linked autocannons for mowing down infantry and light vehicles at distance. The Dark Angel's Mortis Dreadnought is a similar concept. The Hellfire Dreadnought stands back a bit more, essentially acting as a walking gun battery that can still relocate as needed, something a regular artillery piece can't do as well. Some chapters maintain unique special patterns. The Blood Angels and their successors, for instance, have the Furioso Dreadnought. The Furioso is all about aggressive offense, usually equipped with two close combat weapons, both arms ending in power claws or fists, sometimes even talons that drip promethium to ignite targets. A Furioso Dreadnought just barrels into the foe head-on, ripping and tearing like an 8-meter-tall metal berserker. It epitomizes the close combat fervor of the Blood Angels. They even have a terrifying offshoot of this, the Death Company Dreadnought, like Kassor the Damned, whom we'll discuss soon, wherein a Dreadnought Yeet's occupant is one of those Blood Angels who has succumbed to the Black Rage. Imagine a dreadnought that's already a deadly rampaging engine, but piloted by a half-insane marine consumed by visions of his Primarch's death. The result is as frightening as it sounds to friend and foe alike. There are also dreadnoughts that carry particular honors or roles. Venerable dreadnoughts are not a separate pattern of machine, but rather a title given to those that house the oldest and most esteemed warriors. Venerable dreadnoughts often have better craftsmanship or relic components, and their machine spirits, the quasi-consciousness of the machine, are said to be more responsive. On the tabletop, if one were to think of game terms, venerable dreads are a tad harder to kill, reflecting how determined and skilled their pilots are at not getting blown up. Or maybe it's just the luck of the truly ancient. They also tend to be covered in more ornamentation, scrolls naming centuries of victories, purity seals, carved reliefs of the chapter's iconography, etc. These are walking shrines as much as weapons. In rare instances, a chapter will even enter one of its psykers or chaplains into a dreadnought. Yes, librarian dreadnoughts exist. The Blood Angels notably use them. Picture a massive armored war machine that not only has a power fist and plasma gun, but can also unleash psychic lightning or mind bolt blasts. It's like a battle tank that can do wizard tricks. Enemies expecting a straightforward heavy unit are in for a rude surprise when that dreadnought starts warping reality around it. Then there are chaplain dreadnoughts, which are exactly what they sound like, a zealous chaplain entombed, who continues to minister to the faithful even as he cracks heads. A chaplain dreadnought often bears the chapter's sacred reliquaries on its hull and has a distinct skull-faced helm built into the sarcophagus casing, reminiscent of the chaplain's traditional skull helm. They intone litanies through external speakers, exhorting nearby marines to fight without fear. In the middle of a battle, you hear this booming metallic voice chanting the Emperor's praise and promising redemption through victory. It's enough to raise any loyal marine spirits, and perhaps send a chill down a heretic's spine. Technology in Warhammer isn't static, despite the Imperium's reputation for stagnation, and dreadnoughts have seen some new developments in recent times. With the introduction of the Primaris Space Marines, a new breed of taller, even more genetically refined space marines, the Adeptus Mechanicus also unveiled a new class of dreadnought for them, the Redemptor Dreadnought. The Redemptor is a brutish hulk, larger than the old patterns, almost akin to the ancient Contemptors in stature, but built with more brutalist design. Its core is a hyperdense microreactor, which gives it tremendous power, enough to lug around heavier weaponry, like the Macroplasma Incinerator, a giant plasma cannon that can fire in two modes, a standard shot or an overcharged blast that risks overheating but can vaporize even super-heavy infantry in one hit, or an onslaught Gatling cannon. Basically, a rotary cannon that spits high-caliber rounds at an insane rate. One arm typically ends in a Redemptor fist, larger than the old power fists, which can have a built-in secondary gun like a heavy flamer or another Gatling gun. The Redemptor sacrifices a bit of the elegance of the older dreadnoughts for sheer aggressive output. It barrels forward, guns blazing, then smashes what's left at close range. However, this innovation came at a cost, as often is the case with the Mechanicus. The systems of a Redemptor dreadnought are extremely taxing on the pilot. The neural feedback, the raw power coursing through the interface, is overwhelming. The Mechanicus designers, in their cold logic, considered the pilot almost like a replaceable fuse. If he burns out, well, a small price to pay for an engine of war that might win a battle. And burnout they do. Many Primaris Marines interred in Redemptors can only endure a limited number of combat deployments before their biological components fail. There are grim reports of Redemptors standing silent on the battlefield after a hard-won victory, only for the Tech Marines to open the sarcophagus and find the hero inside has been effectively cooked, reduced to a lifeless husk by the stress and neural strain. To the Adeptus Mechanicus, this is an unfortunate but acceptable trade-off. To the Astartes chapters, it's a tragedy, albeit one they accept if it means the chapter survives. It adds another layer of poignancy. These newest dreadnoughts burn the candle at both ends, blazing brightly but briefly, the pilot giving literally all that remains of his life in a final blaze of glory. To truly understand what makes dreadnoughts so compelling and terrifying, it helps to hear some of their stories. Let's delve into a few famous dreadnoughts and their great deeds, tales recounted in chapter legend and imperial record alike. First, there is Bjorn the Fell-Handed of the Space Wolves chapter. If any single dreadnought deserves the title legendary, it's him. Bjorn is, as of the 41st millennium, the oldest living space marine in the galaxy, living in the loosest sense, since much of him is machinery at this point. He fought in the Horus Heresy itself 10,000 years ago. As a young warrior, Bjorn served as one of Primarch Leman Rus's honor guard. He earned renown during the Great Crusade and Heresy, battling traitor marines and demons alike. His moniker, Fell-Handed, originates from one of those early heroic deeds. In combat with a towering demon of Khorne, Bjorn's hand was severed, yet he still picked up his weapon. Legend says he grabbed a lightning claw from a fallen comrade and leapt at the beast, slashing out its throat. The Primarch Leman Rus, impressed by this fearless act, dubbed him the Fell-Handed and elevated him to his personal retinue. Bjorn even stood by Rus during pivotal moments like the burning of Prospero, where the Space Wolves fought the Thousand Suns Legion. After the Heresy, when Leman Rus disappeared on his mysterious final voyage, Bjorn became the first Great Wolf, Chapter Master, of the Space Wolves. He led the chapter with distinction for many years. Eventually, as happens even to the mightiest, Bjorn was grievously wounded. Some accounts say it was during a raid on a Chaos stronghold, others during an attack by rebel humans. Near death, he was interred in a dreadnought to save his life, and thus began his second career as the Eternal Warrior of Fenris. As a dreadnought, Bjorn continued to serve with ferocity. In the centuries afterward, he fought in wars too numerous to list, from repelling a massive orc wag to dueling the traitorous Primarch Magnus the Red, now a demon prince, during the catastrophic burning of Fenris. In that fight, Bjorn managed to badly hurt Magnus. Some say the most damage Magnus had taken since fighting Rus himself, before Magnus shattered Bjorn's weaponry and nearly destroyed his chassis. Even so, Bjorn survived, and his mere presence had rallied the Space Wolves to ultimately drive off the invaders. Because Bjorn is such a precious living relic, the Space Wolves now wake him only rarely. He's said to slumber for decades or centuries at a time in the Fang, their fortress, in a special vault deep beneath the surface. They rouse him in times of greatest need, like when the chapter's very existence is threatened, or occasionally for matters of great ceremonial importance. For instance, at the dawn of each new century, Bjorn is awakened to attend the Great Feast, a celebration where he holds court and recounts tales of the chapter's ancient past. Picture that scene. A grand hall filled with rowdy space wolves, all pounding tables and drinking ale the way only genetically enhanced giants can, and at the head, a venerable dreadnought, scarred, draped in wolf pelts and honor badges, recounting first-hand memories of fighting alongside their primarch. It's like having a direct conversation with mythology. Outside the space wolves, Bjorn is nearly as revered. When he was encountered by agents of the Inquisition after a certain campaign, during the aftermath of the First War for Armageddon, even the proud Inquisitors and Grey Knights present felt compelled to kneel in respect upon realizing they stood before a warrior who had known the Emperor himself. Bjorn, true to his blunt nature, reportedly found this all very tiresome and told everyone to stand up because he had business to settle. That business happened to be him mediating a very tense standoff between the Space Wolves and the Inquisition, and thanks to his wisdom and perhaps the gravitas he carried, he prevented what could have been a disastrous internecine conflict. Having sorted that out, Bjorn likely grumbled something about needing a long rest and asked to be left alone again. From the hallowed halls of Fenris, let's turn to a tragic hero from a once proud legion. Ancient Relanor of the Emperor's Children was a dreadnought known as the Unyielding, and his tale is one of loyalty against impossible odds. During the Horus Heresy, the Emperor's Children Legion betrayed the Imperium under the sway of their Primarch Fulgrim. But not every legionary went along. On Istvan III, the first culling of loyalists among the traitor legions, Rylanor proved true to his oaths. He was an Ancient of Rites, a ceremonial officer and veteran in the Legion, already interred in a Contemptor pattern dreadnought after sustaining grievous wounds fighting Xenos before the Heresy. When Fulgrim tried to purge the loyal Emperor's Children by virus-bombing Istvan III, Rylanor survived. He fought alongside heroes like Captain Saul Tarvitz in the ruins of that world, doing his best to thwart the traitors' plans. In the end, Istvan III fell to the traitors, and the loyalist remnants were thought dead, but Rylanor endured. For 10,000 years, the lonely dreadnought remained on that poisonous, lifeless planet, hiding beneath the wreckage, sustained by hatred and whatever slim resources he had. He was utterly alone. His only companions, the whispers of memory and the all-consuming need for vengeance on his turncoat, Primarch. Fast forward millennia. Fulgrim, now a debased demon prince of Slaanesh, did eventually heed a curious signal from Istvan III. It was Rylanor broadcasting a lure. When Fulgrim arrived to investigate this ghost from his past, Rylanor made his final stand. He had rigged the entire area with one of the unused virus bombs that had failed to detonate during the original atrocity. As Fulgrim confronted the lone Contemptor, Rylanor detonated the device. The resulting cataclysm obliterated the already ruined landscape in a green cloud of deadly biocatalytic virus and flame. Fulgrim, being a demon Primarch, was terribly wounded but not killed. As the story goes, he was scarred and his pride wounded more than anything. But Rylanor's act denied Fulgrim his prize and exacted a measure of poetic justice for the loyal brothers slain so long ago. Rylanor himself was destroyed in the explosion, finally earning the rest that had been denied him for ages. His memory survives as a legend, a byword for unwavering loyalty. In official Imperial records, Rylanor was long listed as presumed killed in action, but amongst those who know the truth, he's honored as the Dreadnought who waited centuries for revenge and delivered it. Now, consider the tale of Breyarth Ashmantle of the Salamanders, a chapter famed for resilience and fiery wrath. Once he was Captain Sokar Breyarth of the Salamanders' 4th Company, a fearsome warrior known for his stubborn determination, even by Salamander standards, and merciless approach to the Emperor's foes. During a campaign cleansing the moons of Imgarl from a Genestealer infestation, Breyarth was mortally wounded. His body was shattered, but his indomitable spirit lingered on. The Salamanders have a special reverence for their war gear and heroes. After much deliberation and reading of omens, they decided to inter Breyarth in one of their chapter's most ancient relics. A unique ironclad dreadnought chassis called the Iron Dragon. Salamander's legend holds that the Iron Dragon was forged by their Primarch Vulcan himself. It's an irreplaceable artifact, ornately detailed and incredibly powerful, but also temperamental. Only a marine with a will of iron could master the Iron Dragon's machine spirit without losing himself. Breyarth was such a man. Upon taking up this new iron form, Braciarth wasted no time in adding to his saga. During his very first deployment as a dreadnought, amid the smoky depths of an underhive rebellion, Braciarth pursued a band of chaos renegades into the subterranean tunnels beneath the city. Days passed with no contact. Most assumed the ancient was lost, perhaps ambushed in the dark by foul sorcery, or simply trapped by a cave-in. But 9 days later, the earth trembled and a massive, soot-stained dreadnought smashed up through the concrete floor of a plaza. It was Braciarth. He had spent over a week hunting and exterminating every last foe in the underground labyrinth. His green armor was completely blackened by ash and grime, almost unrecognizable. Not a single inch was unmarred. When amazed fellow salamanders greeted him, he supposedly rumbled, "Area secure," as if nothing were out of the ordinary. From that incident, he earned the name Ashmantle, literally mantled in ash. Braciarth continued to serve with distinction. He was notably awakened to fight in the Badab War, where renegade Space Marine chapters had turned against the Imperium. There, Ashmantle tore through traitor strongholds, his ironclad frame impervious to heavy fire, exacting Vulcan's wrath with flame and fist. Such was his reputation that even after victory, Chapter Master Tushan is said to have allowed Braciarth to return to his rest only begrudgingly. The Ancient would have eagerly continued smashing the foes of man without pause, but even a dreadnought's might has limits and need for maintenance. To the salamanders, Braciarth Ashmantle remains a revered figure, the embodiment of their forge-tempered resolve, literally walking through fire and darkness to emerge triumphant. Not all dreadnought sagas are purely glorious. Some are bittersweet or downright horrifying. One famous or infamous case is Ancient Kassor, better known as Kassor the Damned, of the Blood Angels. His story exemplifies the unique curse that chapter bears. Long ago, Kassor was Brother Captain Keeler, alternatively recorded as Kezellon in some sources, of the Blood Angels' Second Company. A peerless warrior, undefeated in duels, with centuries of service. During a campaign against the Eldar, he was cut in twain by a Xenos blade. Miraculously, his will kept him clinging to life. The Blood Angels interred him in a dreadnought, allowing this champion to fight on. For nearly 300 years, he did just that, earning the nickname the Fury of Bale for the wrath he visited on the chapter's enemies. But the Blood Angels carry the black rage in their gene seed, a creeping insanity that can strike even the mightiest hero, drowning him in hallucinations of Sanguinius's last stand. Tragically, even in the cold, metal form of a dreadnought, Brother Keeler succumbed to this genetic curse. Imagine the horror. One day, the Blood Angels' tech marines go to wake their ancient champion, and he's gone mad inside that sarcophagus, roaring and thrashing, believing himself on the slopes of the Imperial Palace fighting Horus's armies. They manage to restrain him. One shudders to think how much trouble it was to subdue a rampaging dreadnought. Following tradition, they repainted his armor black with red crosses, marking him as one of the Death Company, those consumed by the Black Rage. He was given a new name, reflecting his damned condition, Kassor. They chained his limbs when he wasn't in battle, literally chaining the dreadnought to a secure hold so he wouldn't launch into a berserker fury at inappropriate times. Kassor the Damned became the chapter's crazed attack dog, unleashed only in the direst battles where his destructive rage could be pointed solely at the enemy. During the Cryptis campaign against a massive Tyranid invasion, Kassor was set loose alongside other Death Company marines. In the apocalyptic struggle on the moon of Asphodix, he actually saved the life of Captain Carlin, the Blood Angels' first company commander. as Carlen was about to be slain by a giant Tyranid creature known as the Spawn of Cryptis. Kasser barreled in, intercepting the blow with his own armored body, and proceeded to tear the Xenos limb from limb. Even that wasn't enough to put him down. Consumed by battle madness, Kasser then charged a monstrous Carnifex, a huge Tyranid war beast, and engaged it at point-blank range. In the ensuing clash, the Carnifex was destroyed, and so was Kasser's dreadnought body. When the smoke cleared, the Blood Angels found Kasser's chassis shattered, and the ancient warrior within finally dead. After the campaign, Commander Dante read the roll of honored dead. Upon reaching Kasser's name, he paused, recalling the proud Captain Keeler that Kasser once was. Dante decreed that in the annals of the chapter, Kasser would be remembered by his original name and deeds, not just as a deranged monster. In effect, death had finally expunged the curse from their brother, and he was given back his honor. The tale of Kasser the Damned is a solemn reminder that even a dreadnought, normally a figure of stability and wisdom, can fall victim to inner demons. It underscores the fine line between a living icon and a cautionary tale. Virtually every chapter can tell you about some heroic dreadnought in its ranks, or tragic ones. The Ultramarines speak of ancient Gallatin, who fell holding the line against endless Tyranids on Prandium, or of ancient Helveticus, who guarded Gilliman's stasis tomb for centuries. The Imperial Fists recall ancient Thasius, who fought on the walls of the Imperial Palace in the Horus Heresy, and still advises their chapter masters. Even lesser-known chapters have their revered ancients. The Iron Hands' ancient Banus led an entire clan company after his interment, turning his personal tragedy, wounds taken during the Heresy, into a symbol of the Iron Hands' credo that flesh is weak, but the machine endures. The Howling Griffins have a story of Chaplain Dreadnought Titus, who, during the Badab War, allowed himself to be surrounded and destroyed by traitors to buy time for his brothers. The humbled enemy, impressed by his stand, even laid his broken sarcophagus to rest in a circle of their own fallen's weapons, an honor from enemy to enemy. Such tales are countless. Thus far, we've discussed loyalist dreadnoughts, those serving the Emperor. But there are, of course, those who serve chaos. The traitor legions and renegade chapters also make use of dreadnoughts, though in their hands this gift becomes a twisted curse. Chaos dreadnoughts are often called hellbrutes now, to distinguish just how corrupted they've become. Imagine the same concept. A mortally wounded super soldier entombed in a machine. But remove the discipline and faith, and add the mutating, maddening influence of the warp. The result is as horrific as you'd expect. Many Chaos Dreadnought pilots eventually lose their sanity utterly. Some have been trapped in their metal coffins for 10,000 years, with only hatred and the whispers of demons for company. They rampage in battle in a state of perpetual psychotic fury. Chaos warbands literally treat them like attack dogs, locking them up between battles, often in chains or sarcophagus stasis, because otherwise they might go berserk on their own allies. When a fight is about to begin, they'll unleash the Hellbrute, pointing it at the enemy and standing back to let the thing vent its centuries of pent-up bloodlust. The physical form of a Chaos Dreadnought often reflects its corruption. The once clean lines of a Contemptor, or Castra Ferrum, are warped and fused with fleshy growths and demonic visages. Tubes might spill out like entrails, armor plates corroded and spiked. Some Hellbrutes graft additional limbs or weaponry in grotesque ways. The Emperor's children, hedonists of Chaos, have sonic dreadnoughts that mount immense speakers and warp amplifiers, so instead of an assault cannon firing shells, it blasts demonic noise that can liquefy organs. The Death Guard's plague-infested hellbrutes ooze diseased ichor and carry batteries of slime projectors. In battle, a hellbrute is terrifying and unpredictable. It might charge headlong like a rabid beast, guns firing wildly. Or sometimes its original tactical acumen flickers through and it executes disturbingly effective maneuvers, all while howling unspeakable war cries. There are a few Chaos Dreadnoughts who still retain more of their mind, becoming dark mirror images of loyal ancients. For example, Malkarion, the war sage of the Night Lord's Legion, was interred in a dreadnought after the Siege of Terra. Unlike many of his peers, he kept a hold, mostly, on his sanity and tactical brilliance. He essentially acted as an advisor and occasional battering ram for his warband. In one famous incident, his warband was being torn apart by internal rivalries and hunted by other traitors. A young Night Lord officer, desperate for guidance, awoke Malkarion, who had refused to be active for centuries. Malkarion promptly took command and led them in a campaign that temporarily restored their fortunes. During that campaign, he confronted a Blood Angels dreadnought named Raguel. Ironically, Raguel was a loyalist whom Malkarion had actually slain in person during the Siege of Terra 10,000 years earlier, and who had later been interred in a dreadnought himself. In a grimly poetic duel, the two ancient enemies, one traitor, one loyal, both far removed from who they once were, fought again. Each essentially killed the other for a second time. Malkarion was last seen collapsing after ripping Raguel's sarcophagus open. Malkarion's story ended there, more or less. There are conflicting whispers that his cruel brothers dragged his remains along to try to repair him against his own wishes to die. It illustrates that a dreadnought's longevity can be as much a curse for traitors as for the faithful. Even a strong-willed traitor like Malkarion eventually succumbed to an existence of unending war and woke into a galaxy that held nothing but hollow purpose for him. Another illustrative case, the hellbrute Kjarvik of the World Eaters, a traitor legion. Kjarvik was said to have moments of lucidity where he realized he was a monster and begged his fellow World Eaters to let him die. They, of course, did not. Instead, they deliberately goaded him into berserk rages because they found it useful and, frankly, entertaining. His every waking moment was pain and anger, and he had no choice but to unleash it on anyone in reach. One day, perhaps his wish was granted, and an enemy destroyed him. But who can say? The Chaos Gods take a perverse pleasure in denying final rest to their pawns. The existence of dreadnoughts, both loyal and traitor, underscores one of the core truths of Warhammer 40,000. There is only war, and it never ends. The loyalist dreadnoughts are the embodiments of duty eternal, heroes who quite literally fight beyond the grave. They're terrifying to the enemy, because you cannot deter them, cannot demoralize them, and often cannot even kill them unless you obliterate them entirely. They don't feel fear or pain the way a normal being would. Or rather, even if they do, it won't stop them. How do you scare someone who has already faced death and come out the other side? Good luck. If anything, it's the Dreadnought who instills fear in you by showing that the Emperor's wrath is so great that not even death will make it back off. For the Space Marines themselves, Dreadnoughts are a source of both great pride and a subtle, unspoken dread. Every battle brother knows, at least in theory, that he could one day be chosen for this honor. On a practical level, they all revere the ancients and would be awed to have their guidance. But in the quiet of their own hearts, some likely think, would I want that if it came to it? To never truly die, but never truly live again, either? It's a heavy question. We outsiders might romanticize the dreadnought as a glorious second life, and indeed it is a form of immortality, of continued glory and service. But it's also a surrender of one's flesh and a commitment to indefinite war. Space Marines live for war, yes, but even they have moments of fellowship, of rest, of simple bodily pleasures like food or drink, or for the space wolves a good mug of ale. A dreadnought has none of that. Many are basically stored away until battle, in darkness, in silence. It can be argued that their existence between wars is akin to death, with only brief awakenings that might be confusing or disorienting. It's small wonder that some are grumpy or curt. Their patience for frivolity is zero. And yet, despite that somber aspect, the Space Marines consider it one of the highest honors. Because what greater act of devotion is there than to give not just your life, but your death to the Emperor? To say, "Even in death I still serve," as is inscribed on many Dreadnoste sarcophagi. In a universe assailed on all sides by horrors, heroes who won't die are as necessary as they are frightening. In the end, Dreadnoughts stand as enduring symbols of the Imperium's will. They are brutal, they are relentless, and they carry within them the wisdom of ages. Enemies call them Dead Walkers, or the Ancients, with a mix of fear and respect. Allies step a little lighter and straighten their backs when in the presence of an Ancient, not out of fear but out of reverence and the desire to prove worthy of fighting alongside a legend. When a Dreadnought falls, which is rare, but it does happen if the enemy is lucky and the circumstances dire, the chapter will go to extraordinary lengths to reclaim the body. Often it's not even about hoping the hero inside could be saved. If the sarcophagus is breached, the occupant usually perishes. It's about preserving his remains and the machine for proper interment and honor. Many a last stand has been fought over a downed Dreadnought's chassis, with Marines willingly dying to ensure their Ancient's body isn't defiled or lost. If recovery is impossible and a Dreadnought is truly gone, the company or chapter affected will hold funeral rites akin to losing a founding father. To the common people of the Imperium, if they ever witness a Dreadnought, it must seem like seeing one of the Emperor's avenging angels cast in metal. Many Imperial citizens live their whole lives only hearing fantastical rumors of such things. If one strides through their Hive City streets one day, they probably think a god has come to save them. Perhaps in a way, one has. So, Dreadnoughts, the most terrifying space marines. Terrifying for the enemy, certainly, these towering engines of destruction piloted by undying heroes. But perhaps on some level, slightly terrifying for the space marines themselves. A reminder that their duty truly has no end. That even death is not an escape from the burden of service. Terrifying and inspiring and sobering all at once. In the grim ledger of the far future, a Dreadnought is both an asset and a statement. It says to the foe, "No matter what you do, we will not yield. Kill us, and we will rise again stronger. We have heroes who will fight you even when life has left them." It says to the Imperium's people, "See the price we are willing to pay for your safety, and take heart." And to the Space Marines, it whispers, "There is always more duty to be done." Ultimately, these ironclad veterans embody the Imperium's defiance. They will continue to stand long after a normal warrior would have fallen, anchored by faith and fury. They are the bulwark that holds when all else fails, the fist that strikes when all others are broken. As long as a single noble soul is willing to inhabit those ancient metal shells, the Imperium of Man will never admit defeat.